Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's been 2 years since the World Trade Center towers were attacked. 2 years since that Tuesday morning in early September when 3,000 people died in the most dramatic and deadly attack ever on the United States. That day changed the world in ways that are immediately measurable, with wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and international relations forever altered. Here in America, the events of 9/11 spawned the U.S. Patriot Act and the War on Terror and so much more. But the 2 years that have passed since that day have allowed enough space to look at some of the more symbolic effects of the attack. The filmmaker Rick Burns has done this with his in-depth documentary on the Twin Towers. He calls it The Center of the World. And while that title seems apt today, it's not what most people thought of the World Trade Center towers 2 years ago, and certainly not 22 years ago when they were first opened and begging for tenants. Connection listeners, Rick Burns has a closer look at these towers of concrete and steel, shows them as vertical milestones of modern American history, or parables for American power. What do you think? How do you see them? 2 years since the attacks, where do you fit the towers into your own sense of that time? Do the towers and the memory of them hold lessons for America today? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us from the NPR studio in New York is the documentary filmmaker Rick Burns. His last film in an 8-part series on the history of New York is called The Center of the World. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And also joining us, Guy Tozzoli, who back in 1962 was appointed director of the World Trade Development with the Port Authority. In this position, he was the man in charge of planning and constructing and renting and operating the World Trade Center's towers of New York. Guy, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Let me start, Rick, with you, because this is a film that wasn't even supposed to be made.
Well, that's right. I mean, my colleagues and I have been working on the series New York documentary film for, the better part of a decade by 2001, and had finished, in the spring or summer of 2001, the last two episodes, which coincidentally were broadcast just a couple of weeks after 9/11. We thought we had finished it. We had 14 and a half hours of film. And then, really, within days of the attack, it was apparent to us that there was a story we had left out, a very big story, a story that had been hiding in plain sight, which was the story of the World Trade Center, not only covering, of course, that last terrible chapter of its demise, but this extraordinary history, going back surprisingly long to the, right back to 1946 when the idea was first broached.
Why do you suppose, Rick, that you missed it? Why do you think they were hiding in plain sight, as you say?
I think for a number of reasons. I think one had to do with the controversy surrounding the buildings and with the fact that they had the misfortune of opening these monuments to sort of to trade and commerce at a very moment when trade and commerce was on a downturn. I mean, the early mid-1970s were the time of the famous fiscal crisis in New York City and a recession generally around the country and around the world. And people did not really like the buildings very much when they opened. They didn't seem to be what people had in mind when they looked at the New York skyline. Although the intent of their builders had been quite the opposite, they were not warmly greeted, I think it's safe to say, by as many people as the Port Authority would have liked. And so, who the engineers were, who the extraordinary personalities behind the buildings, the role of the Rockefeller family in that. All those things, I think, got pushed to one side as people had a little bit of a yeah attitude and wanted to kind of go on with business. And it was only, when they were destroyed that people suddenly began to realize intuitively, these buildings were the most iconic structures on the most familiar skyline in the world. And they really told us so much about where we'd come from and the forces that had put them up. And that dawned on us rather immediately as well.
Guy Tozzoli, if we could just imagine for a minute that the World Trade Center towers were still standing and you were sitting there with Rick Burns' filmmaking team trying to make the case about why we should pay attention to them before the attack, what would you say? What would you have said at that time?
This is very interesting. The World Trade Center concept, as Rick said, really began in 1946. And with the help of David Rockefeller, the Rockefeller team, the Port Authority was asked, and I was given the job, to create the World Trade Center. It was authorized to help people do international business. And one thing that not too many people realize, it created more new office space, not by itself, but there is more new office space was built in Lower Manhattan because of the World Trade Center than exists in any other city in the world, with the exception of Chicago and Midtown Manhattan.
So you're saying the decision to build that building is in many ways the point that made New York the financial capital that it still is today.
It always was a financial capital. But Lower Manhattan specifically, New York is almost has like two different cities. There's a mid-Manhattan, there's Lower Manhattan. And sometimes they don't mix with one another. And Lower Manhattan had been dying since World War II. And there the Rockefellers said this. They had a big building. They built the only new tower, the Chase Manhattan building, since World War II. And so people were moving out, and most of them were moving to mid-Manhattan, or some of them moving out of the city.
I wonder if we can just listen to a little bit of Rick Burns' film. This is actual footage of Rockefeller talking about that time and that moment in those buildings.
The downtown Manhattan area is one of the most valuable and uniquely situated pieces of real estate in the entire world. The central core area of towering skyscrapers is surrounded by acres of marginal buildings, the majority of which are more than a century old and only partly occupied.
And Rick Burns, had it not been for David and John Rockefeller, would the World Trade Center towers ever have been built?
Oh, no question that would never have been built without the Rockefeller brothers, and especially without David. I mean, it was very useful for David that his older brother Nelson happened to become governor of New York and therefore could help place much of the public power of New York State behind this extraordinary plan. But it was David who had, I mean, I think it's not too much to say, a kind of visionary foresight to see that one way or the other, times were changing. Lower Manhattan was changing. The port was shifting. New technologies were going to transform shipping and make the port of Lower Manhattan even more obsolete. It needed to become something else. And David grasped that. And instead of saying, okay, we'll abandon Lower Manhattan as so many other bankers and financial people were doing or considering doing, even the stock exchange was going to move, contemplating a move up to Midtown. David said, no, we're going to save this oldest and most prestigious part of New York, this old financial center, and we're going to transform it into a new kind of port, a port devoted not to the transfer of material goods, but to the transfer of ideas and the transfer of money into a paper port, so to speak.
And something that you do in the documentary, which I find intriguing, is you place that in context of what else is happening in the country. You remind us that this is, you know, coming at the same time as John F. Kennedy gave an inaugural address talking about exploring the stars, and the time when the Apollo moonshots were in the headlines, a time when America was really looking for ways to express its strength and power.
I mean, I think that the 50-year period after the Second World War, and especially the 1960s, were this tremendous period. The two axes of those periods were up in a tremendous way, of which the Moon Project and buildings like the World Trade Center were the great exemplars, and out, this kind of tremendous reach out across the world. And as we moved up and out during the 1960s, it made the 1960s one of the most dynamic and extraordinary and sometimes foolish and frenetic decades in the city's and the country's history. And right in the middle of that story is the story of the World Trade Center. I mean, Guy, who had everything to do with building it, I mean, it's a thrill to be here with him this morning, only because that's a period in our cities, in our country's history, in world history, which is so crucial. And so much of what we became came out of that moment.
Guy, why did the height matter so much? There's a part in the film where you're talking to or describing a meeting with the architect, Minoru Yamasaki, and saying, no, they got to be 110 stories tall. 80's not enough.
I think really it was, we wanted 10 million square feet of space. And the only way
Million, why not 7? Why not 8? What's with 10 million?
Because I wanted to use every square foot that was allowed under the zoning laws. And people missed that. And so 10 million became what we called my program. And Yama loved the Twin Towers. And I loved the Twin Towers. And I remember, and Rick covered this in his documentary, when I said to Yama, you know, you tell me you can't build buildings taller than 80 floors. That's an impossibility. That's just not true. So therefore, I think you can reconcile the two. And it so happened that 2 million feet brought us to the 110-story buildings by Yama's plans. And that's really the reason.
Rick, you also...
I think every 50 years, America goes through a tremendous surge. And I think the 1960s, like the 1920s in a different way, was one of those moments. So many extraordinary things happen every now and then, every generation or two. And the 1960s was really one of them. And that moment when the World Trade Center was going up was really so extraordinary. We were really reaching for the sky and reaching for the stars in a way that, you know, it's given to cultures only occasionally in their lifetimes to do it. And that's, to me, one of the most, what makes it so moving.
Something else you do with the film, which I find interesting, Rick, is that you're not in any kind of a hurry to rush us ahead to the dramatic footage of 9/11. You take the time, lots of time, to tell the stories of the characters and the people that lead up to that moment. And so when, late in the documentary, we see that plane, the little silhouette of the plane streaking across the sky, I, who have never lived in New York, experience for the what I think is the first time a little bit of what New Yorkers may have felt in seeing the assault on the buildings as something personal. And I don't mean to diminish for a minute all the people who lost friends and family, but rather what you're pointing us to, the personality of the buildings.
I think that I'm glad to hear that. I think that was very much our hope and intent in the film. I mean, the World Trade Center, the towers, have been so captured by the hideous images of their demise that we really wanted to, in the most forceful way, take people back before the fall to this extraordinary history, which, as we were saying before, has been, I think, way too overlooked until now, and document the characters, the Rockefeller brothers, the Guy Tizzolis, the Austin Tobin, the extraordinary head of the Port Authority from 1942 to the early 1970s, Minoru Yamasaki, the architect, Philippe Petit, the high wire artist who sort of did nothing and did everything when he walked between the two towers in August of 1974 and transformed permanently the way people saw those buildings and what they felt about them. We wanted to sort of backfill all that history and the tremendous roller coaster ride so that when people came back, inevitably as they must, to the moment of their demise, they would understand more clearly what the buildings had meant, the very different things they had meant, the very different motives behind their construction, and therefore, in a way, understand maybe more deeply what we had lost.
Connection listeners, have you, in the 2 years since that time, taken a look at the missing buildings on the New York skyline and, as Rick describes, seen what they meant and what has been lost? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public Radio.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking about Rick Burns' documentary, The Center of the World, that takes us through the history of the World Trade Center towers. We were talking just before the break about this character, Philippe Petit. And he's one who, if you haven't seen the film, he's a tightrope walker from France who, just a year after the dedication ceremony of the two towers, snuck his way up to the top and actually managed to walk between the towers. Here he is describing his first steps onto the wire.
Whenever other worlds invite us, whenever we are balancing on the boundaries of our limited human condition, that's where life starts. That's where you start feeling yourself living. So when I found myself 1 foot on the wire, 1 foot on the building, and ready to decide to shift my way to become a bird, it was not something new. And after a few steps, I I knew I was in my element. I didn't even took the full length of the crossing to get to know the rigging and the vibration of the building and the wire. And then very slowly as I walked, I was overwhelmed by a sense of easiness, a sense of simplicity. And actually I can be seen on the first pictures smiling probably out of disbelief.
And in a use of footage from that time, Rick Burns also introduces us to Sergeant Charles Daniels of the Port Authority, who was sent to the roof to arrest Philippe Petit.
Well, after arriving on the rooftop, Officer Myers and I observed the tightrope dancer, because you couldn't call him a walker, approximately halfway between the two towers. And upon seeing us, he started to smile and laugh, and he started going into a dancing routine on the high wire. He then went down to one knee, and we stepped to the background, and I said for everyone to be quiet. And at this time, he laid down on the high wire, and, you know, just lackadaisically rolled around on the wire, like, unbelievably, really, to the point that everybody was spellbound in the watching of it. And I personally figured I was watching something that somebody else would never see again in the world. Thought it was once in a lifetime.
In fact, that one event had quite an impact on Guy Tozzoli, who at that time was director of the World Trade Department, and you weren't mad at this guy.
I certainly wasn't. Philippe had really fooled me, because when he first introduced himself to me, he introduced himself as a French journalist, and the people who were to help him, his two assistants, were photographers. But he kept asking me, how do the buildings move in the wind? And I didn't know what that really meant until I was advised by radio that someone was walking on a wire, as they called it, between the Twin Towers. And Philippe was just such a lovely man.
His walk between the two buildings, did that change the stature of those buildings?
I think people began to realize that they just weren't two big blocks. There was a beautiful plaza that, you know, when we finished it, we had shows there. We had all kinds of demonstrations. We had all kinds of activities in the plaza. And at noon, the shops were set up, believe it or not, so the people in the Trade Center, 50,000 people working there, and so they could shop. And then when we took the landfill out of the bottom of the World Trade Center and put it in the river to create the World Financial Center, we were now joining something else to it. And it became a bigger-than-life thing. And the people who worked there just loved being at the Trade Center.
And Rick, this is, listening to Guy, it's a fascinating insight onto the way it was seen by the people who were so close to the building. But you're also marking with the film a shift to the way that those two buildings were seen by people outside. Because at some point in a desert in Afghanistan in 1999, people chose those buildings as targets. And I think part of what you want to show us is that they were being seen as targets by people on the other side of the world even before they were seen as any kind of symbol right in New York or in America.
I think there was a big gap between the way New Yorkers in particular and Americans in general saw the World Trade Center towers and the way they were understood quite generally abroad. The historian Niall Ferguson, who we talked to, I found fascinating in our film, talked about it's a kind of a sort of a schizophrenic attitude towards globalization. We didn't really see how much here in New York those towers had come to stand for the very world trade that was inscribed in their name. Partly that had to do with the time that they had come out and some of the controversies. But even down at the end of the 1990s, we saw them in a more parochial way. Meanwhile, in that 25-year period from 1975 to the turn of the century, they had acquired a set of extremely potent meanings. New York was the most powerful city. It was the hub city of a truly extraordinary and unprecedented global trading empire. And for people who had problems with that trading empire, for people who felt encroached upon it in any one of a number of ways, there's no question that those towers stood for and stood at the epicenter of a society and a set of forces, capitalism, democracy, globalization, about which some people felt very ambivalent. We didn't realize that. I don't think it really occurred to many people.
There's one more interesting thing, I think, that we could put at this time. When we began to build in the late 60s and early 70s, people came to me from other countries, and their questions were always the same. What is a World Trade Center? And if it's good for New York, maybe it's good for our city or our country. And so in 1970, I began the World Trade Centers Association, one to encourage building of other World Trade Centers in the world and working together to create, through trade, peace and stability. That's very important. We started with 16 World Trade Centers in 7 countries in 1970. Today, there are 286 World Trade Centers. There are 92 countries. Those 92 countries and those trade centers service more than 750,000 international companies. You know, in the United States, when I first started in 1960, I was also the director of the World Trade, helping this port of New York, New Jersey, that international trade accounted for 2.7% of our gross national product in the United States. Today, it's 22.5%. And I think that's something that people didn't pay too much attention to. But the interesting part, in spite of the fact that it was hit by people from a different part of the world, from that part of the world in the Middle East, do you know that the World Trade Center Dubai is the tallest building in the Emirates, and it's been that way for about 25 years?
Let me stop you there if I can, Guy, because a number of people want to join us on the phone. We'll go first to Ellen, who's calling in from Grafton, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellen.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I saw the film last night on PBS, and it was beautiful and agonizing to watch. And the issue I would raise was, in the film, Mr. Burns says that actually New Yorkers were suffering from a certain insularity, so that they saw the World Trade Center one way and the world was viewing it quite another way.
Yeah, we were just talking about that.
Right. Those buildings really were office buildings, and I think that insularity maybe is more of New Yorkers' typical calling a spade a spade. It was an office building, and office workers who were there to do their job got killed that day. And I think it's actually quite the other way, that the world imposed a view on something that was really much more matter of fact.
You know, I think it's a very fascinating point, and I think it's very eloquently put. I do think, however, that there's a kind of... things can be both one thing and another. There can be a local reality, which is very compelling, and in fact, very much what the day-to-day reality of those buildings were. A workplace. 50,000 people went to that workplace. They were an office building. They were a place where white-collar workers and the people who serviced those white-collar offices went to work. But, you know, that building and thus those workers, white-collar and otherwise, were also inextricably entangled in a worldwide system, economic system. That's why they were there. That's why the lights were burning 24 hours, 7 days a week in the World Trade Center on Monday, September 10th, 2001, because New York and that building were connected in a worldwide network, which it's that worldwide network, I think, that we don't always understand, partly because it's just harder to see it.
Well,
it's not as visible to us.
Well, I think that we were also all a little bit taken aback by how connected we ended up being to that event. I mean, who among us didn't know someone who knew someone who was killed on that day? It was in many ways kind of a startling opening up of really how small the country or the continent or the world is, that you'd find out that someone who went to your high school was killed there. And you never would have thought of that if that event hadn't happened. And Ellen, just, to come back to you, did your view of those buildings as just office buildings change on 9/11 or in the days and weeks afterwards?
No, I commuted through those buildings every day for 10 years, and half of my wardrobe comes from stores that were in the main arcade. They were not world symbols to me. The White House is a world symbol, and the Capitol is a world symbol. They were office buildings, and I was lucky I wasn't there that day, you know, and I wonder, not to be pedestrian about it, but if that complex had been named, as you suggested, the Manhattan Business Center, would it have been so compelling a target?
Guy Tozzoli, what do you
think? I think it would
have been. All right, Rick, Guy, go ahead.
I think it would have been a target because it wasn't hit because it was a World Trade Center. In the minds of the people, and let's not forget this, that same group bombed the Trade Center, have it topple, as you heard in the documentary, in 1993, on a very cold February 26th morning, 12:18, they blew a bomb. And I heard the tapes that were captured later of them, the people who placed it, saying they waited for the tower to fall over. But it wasn't because it was a World Trade Center. The very country that they came from had trade centers in every one of them, in Saudi Arabia, in Dubai, in the Emirates. It represented the United States' economic power.
Absolutely. I think that's really absolutely the case. I mean, these were the preeminent symbols.
Correct.
In addition to being a workplace, I think they were arguably the preeminent symbol of our society. So upwardly mobile, so, you know, ambitious in its reach, so democratic. You know, 92 different nationalities died in the building. So multicultural, so global, the World Trade Center, not just a phrase, but in fact embodied in the kind of business that went on there. So that all the things that I think are most American about America, capitalism, democracy, globalization, and a kind of commitment to the future and a commitment to rising, those buildings, I don't think it's forcing it too much, at least in my view, those buildings, more than any other structure in the United States, stood for all those forces, and they were known to stand for it. People who never went there could close their eyes on the other side of the world and form some plausible image of what those two towers looked like. That's extraordinary. I think there are very, very few man-made objects about which that could be said.
Let's move along to Greensboro, North Carolina now. Robert's going to join us on the phone. Robert, go ahead.
How you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Listen, I just wanted to comment. I saw the show last night, and I'm following along with what you're saying regarding the fact that the woman from New York actually felt like they were office buildings. And myself, you know, my father was military, so we traveled quite a bit, so I saw quite a lot. I never went to New York, but the buildings to me were just, you know, one of the tallest buildings out there in the world until I saw this show. It really took me for a roller coaster ride here, developing the personalities of the building and the personal kind of feeling that the people of New York had for them, whether it was disappointment, hatred, or, you know, and then basically in awe of what these structures were. Philly, you know, doing the Higher Wire Act and really bringing people in touch with the building, it sent me, as someone, as an outsider, really gave me a better understanding of what those buildings meant to the people of New York, but in essence, I think that it gave me a better understanding of why things happen that way, the symbolism of those buildings. And she said, you know, not to be too pedestrian as far as just naming those buildings as buildings, but ultimately, I think that's what a lot of American and society lacks is the beauty of what people are doing around us and the construction of these buildings. I mean, that was a monstrous achievement. I mean, millions of hours of man hours constructing and the developing of those shocks to prevent the swaying of the building. You know, it's just a monument to what America is, and it gave me a different perspective on what it was. And not only that, but Rick, you did a great job, I think, in really developing the story from where you did, because I know, Mr. Gordon, you said that, you know, originally, you know, you were expecting to see a bunch of, you know, just shots of planes going into the side of the building,
right,
and that's how we'll start out, but I think I was anticipating that too, and I really liked the way it developed it, because it brought me in farther into what happened. And then what happened is once we started seeing the shots of 9/11, it really brought a lot of emotionality to what was being portrayed. I'd completely forgotten. I mean, 2 years ago, what happened? I remember what I was doing on that day and what I felt and was trying to empathize with the people around me and in New York and America and the world. But I kind of forgot about that.
I wanted to ask Guy Tozzoli what it was like the first time that you saw the film. You were probably at the screening last week, Guy. Had you seen it before that?
I know that was the first time I saw it, and I thought Rick did a magnificent job. I must tell you, and I've told them.
What was it like though? The moment when you began to see the undoing of those towers.
The first reaction. As I think I said this in the film, my first reaction was terrible sadness because I knew that those buildings, when I saw those planes at that speed filled with fuel, that the people above had no chance to get out. Then there was a great sadness followed by anger. How could people do this to people that were working? The people in the World Trade Center towers, they were trying to trade with other people that were trying to help themselves do business. And the utter futility of people being killed like that was a terrible hurt. And then I must tell you, my next reaction was, this is New York, this is the United States. We'll carry on. We'll put Trade Center back there again. I don't know what shape it'll be, but it'll be there to help New York do its trade. And it'll be there to help people build back Lower Manhattan as a vibrant place again, like it was before. And that's how I feel.
Connection listeners, how do you feel 2 years after the attack on the World Trade Center towers about what their weight, value, importance was to this country and whether or not they need to be rebuilt? Is that an important statement that needs to be made? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for NASA.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking with Rick Burns, documentary filmmaker, director, most recently of The Center of the World, about the rise and then the fall and the meaning of the New York City's World Trade Center towers. Guy Tozzoli is also with us. He's president of the World Trade Centers Association, and back in 1962 was appointed as director of the World Trade Department at Port Authority, so was responsible for the planning and construction, rental, and the operation of those two towers. And Rick, maybe I can just start this part of the program by asking you whether or not America will ever build like that again. I get the impression from the gathering of clips and the narration that you've put together that you don't think that could ever happen quite the way it did again.
You know, I think like everything to do with the World Trade Center, you know, the answer to that question is double and contradictory. I sometimes think Minoru Yamasaki was a great genius in figuring out that they should be two towers, as if something in his soul knew that they would always mean more than one thing. So he'd put these two structures so identical next to each other because they would stand for that doubleness or that plurality of meaning. I think that there are many lessons from the World Trade Center's history that impact upon what will be built there, and appropriately enough, those lessons are very paradoxical. On the one hand, we probably never will build according to the template of the World Trade Center in the sense that we won't close off 14 historic streets. We probably will abandon the superblock model. The World Trade Center was built on two superblocks, which in the view of some architects and urbanists and urban historians, turn their back too much on the vitality of street life and pedestrian flow. So I think we're not going to build that way. And I think that although the arguments and debates about what's happening at Ground Zero get more attention in the press, I think it's very important to point out that there's remarkable unanimity about much of what's happening there. no one argues with the fact that we must build and transform the transportation infrastructure of Lower Manhattan. That was one of the biggest problems with Lower Manhattan to begin with, and still not solved, and hopefully will be solved. We're going to put back in some, though not all, of those streets. Whatever is built is not going to be set up on a two-story pedestal, which seemed like a great idea in the early 1960s, but even by the mid to late 60s, there was serious debate about that, whether or not that was a practicable or effective way to build in a city. On the other hand, I'm sure we're going to build tall. That the hopes and feelings that are embodied in tall architecture, I think, are crucial and should never be derided and never be counted out. The World Trade Center might have been built for many motives, but what I think it came to stand for in the minds of so many people was something quite simple and just literally associated with its size. Here was this building that leapt up into the heavens. And we saw that it was a reminder of the extraordinary things that we can do. And in that sense, it was a simple embodiment of hope and aspiration and upward rising, something Philippe Petit, the high wire artist, knew instinctively before they were built. It made him want to sprout wings and get up that high, too, as he did when he danced among the clouds in 1974. So I'm sure in my bones we're going to build something as high or higher. It will take a different form, no doubt. We're in a different moment in history. But that skyline will be restored, and I think it's crucial that it be, because there's a way in which the entire skyline of New York looks lower because those two extraordinary buildings aren't there anymore. We need to have the leader back, and the leader may take a different form, but I look forward to the day when something very tall, something that makes you sort of gasp when you look at it, is there again.
I want to go back to our callers. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Lexington, Massachusetts, and Andrew's joining us. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to disagree with Mr. Burns's opinion about the symbolism of the towers. I think that there are a lot of Americans who see it as representing the most embarrassing aspects of American culture, greed and imperialism, and things that have fostered that have caused major problems throughout the world and that have fostered the terrorism that brought the towers down.
Did you have that opinion of the buildings before 9/11, Andrew?
Before 9/11. I mean, maybe I thought of it first after the first attempts at the tower. I can't really remember, but I used to live in New York and I used to see the towers, and I didn't really think too much about what they meant until it was suggested. But I really think that's a very small part of the country. The corporate America are the ones who have those ideals about reaching and getting all you can. I personally someone was talking about remembering where you were on the day. I used to be in the Coast Guard, and I was on a Coast Guard ship when it happened, and I was thinking, well, what I do for a living is I'm trying to contribute to the country, contribute to society. And I'm not trying to get every penny I can and get as rich as I can. And I think that the World Trade Center really symbolizes that kind of attitude rather than a more civic spirit.
Guy, Rick, either of you want to talk back to
Andrew? Just quickly, I'd like to hear what Guy thinks about that, too. It's funny. I felt very much the way you feel now. In the past, I moved to New York in 1976 when they were just opened. I came from Ann Arbor, Michigan, so I probably don't even have to say that I despised them. I thought they were, I became an instant New Yorker, and I felt that they stood for all the things that you've described them standing for. And I believe that they did stand for that. I think that one of the extraordinary things about these buildings, what made them, if not unique, highly unusual, is that they absorbed so many different feelings and thoughts and ideas and values over time. So they stood for greed and materialism. I think I saw them as the pure embodiment of the military-industrial complex, these harsh, militaristic metal buildings, no Art Deco whimsy about them. And I contrasted them very invidiously to the other buildings in New York, which I had instantly come to feel proprietary about. And yet, over time, I think what's interesting about those buildings is the way they absorb so many different meanings, so many contradictory meanings, and come to stand for things that are paradoxically very contradictory at times. Guy, what did you feel about it?
Yeah, people don't realize that in the middle 70s, when the economy began to come back, the World Trade Center had more than 1,000 tenants. And they weren't all big tenants. They were small tenants. They were people who were doing the processing of international business, which is a big part of what the United States is involved in. And, so it wasn't always people getting rich. Or there were some companies in there that dealt in finance, but in the main, the people were working on the processing and the mechanizing, the modernizing of international business.
Interesting how the two buildings, before and after, still generate such a diversity of opinion. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And to Newton, Massachusetts, Joanne's joining us. Hi, Joanne.
Hi.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking the call. I wanted to say my son's father was on the first plane, and when my son was in the Rockies climbing with the National Outdoor Leadership School at the time the planes hit the building, it took us a couple of days to get to him. But when he heard what had happened, his first response was, put them back and make them taller. I want you guys to hear that a 21-year-old, in the face of the loss of his father, his first response was, put them back and make them taller. The other thing I want to just be sure we don't forget is that they took two planes full of people from Massachusetts and New England and threw them at those buildings. They took two planes full of people from the Mid-Atlantic and destroyed them. It wasn't just the World Trade Center that was attacked. I just want to be sure we don't forget that there were people on the planes, all four of them, as well as the people on the ground and in the towers. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Joanne. Appreciate that. Rick, I suppose in a way, when you're dealing with something that is as close to the bone as this is, that you're always juggling the sense of what a building stands for against everyone else's sense of how much people matter.
Yeah, I think that was the, I think you put your finger on it. There's nothing that one can say in response to the caller, and that's absolutely true, what she's saying. It was another example of how, you know, the event was both local and global, local and national. I mean, it happened in New York, but it happened to people from all over. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the reasons why it had such extraordinary impact was people understood that even though it was happening in New York or happening in Washington, it was happening, in a sense, across the country and across the world. You know, I think it was really one of the first, in that sense, species-wide events, an event that happened to people who were drawn from so many different places and it happened in places that meant things on a global level. You know, we were juggling that question of, you know, the buildings as buildings and the buildings as places where people lived and worked, and in this case where so many people died. It's a very, very difficult story to grasp in that respect.
There is a shot at one point in the film, I can't remember where, that sticks in my mind, of the top 20 or 30 floors of both World Trade Center towers sticking through the clouds. There's nothing else in the picture except these two little bits of building sticking up through the clouds. And, Guy, I wanted to ask you where your office was there. Were you often above the clouds there?
There were times when I was above the clouds, yes. And I was on the 77th floor of number one World Trade Center. And it was an incredible sight. It just was.
Where's your office? Where's your current office?
My current office is right across the street from Grand Central Station in the middle of New York City on 42nd Street. But I must tell you this, if we build 7 World Trade Center again, I am moving back downtown, and I will be there we're the headquarters of the trade centers of the world. And that's why the picture of those two towers was in 280-some-odd cities around the globe, and saying that's our headquarters, the sense of pride that they had, that the World Trade Center movement was centralized and its headquarters was in this city. And incidentally, Boston has a magnificent trade center. Right? It redeveloped the waterfront.
There's a point in the film, The Center of the World, near the end, when we listen to the former governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, quite characteristically being eloquent and explaining how he sees the search for meaning in 9/11.
9/11, how can you possibly use it for good purpose? You think about it. You think, as we've suggested before, you think about, look, what this reminds you of is the importance of your own life and making the most of it, because you can lose it in a flash. And if that's all you learned from 9/11, if that's all you remembered, that, my God, you could extinguish life so suddenly, so unexpectedly, and it could happen to me, and therefore I should think harder about the way I spend my life instead of just wasting it. Now, it's not going to teach you what to do with your life, but it will teach you to do with your life, and to do it more and quicker and better. And that can be extremely valuable. It's had that effect on me.
And Rick Burns, filmmaker, quick last comment from you. What did the effect of pulling all that together have on you?
You know, every film project is a transforming event for the people who make it. I think this, vastly more so than any project I've had the opportunity and privilege to work on. I think it was a very different one because it was partly history and partly something that is so painfully contemporary. I think the real purpose of the film, the pretext, was to do a history of the World Trade Center. But I think in a way that became the scaffolding, and what the real point of the film has been and is to convene the 24 or so New Yorkers that we convened to think and talk out loud about what they think about what the building has meant and how they were affected by its destruction. And in so doing, to perhaps in a kind of, I guess the metaphor that I've come to is in a rabbinical or ministerial way, to help move this all along. We've arrived at a very crucial moment 2 years after. The mourning is coming to an end, and it's a new normalcy is coming in, as Paul Goldberger says in the film. And that's a difficult and complicated moment. And it was our hope that these men and women who spoke to us on camera would help others, as I think they helped us in the process of making the film, put this in perspective.
Rick, I want to thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Guy Tozzoli, thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
Rick Burns, documentary filmmaker. Guy Tozzoli, president of the World Trade Centers Association. More about the film on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.